Okay, well, thank you very much, Gilbert. It's always great to be back at Perimeter and see a lot of old friends. So this talk today is actually mostly work by my student, Avishkar Patel. Actually, formally, he's not my student anymore because he's defended his thesis, and he's going to be a Mentor Fellow at Berkeley in a month or two. So I'm going to talk about some simple models of non-Fermi liquid behavior, especially motivated by a bunch of recent experiments, and we're trying to come up with at least a toy model understanding of what's going on. So let me just begin by just quickly reminding you what the standard solid state physics tells us about metals. So the defining property of an ordinary metal is the presence of these quasi-particle excitations. And you can think of quasi-particle as some generic excitation which has the property that you can combine them to create more excitations. So once you know the set of energies of a single quasi-particle excitation, the epsilon alpha, you can combine them to create a thermodynamic set of excitations, which are exponentially many, just by changing the occupation numbers in alpha. Of course, they interact with each other, that changes the energy, but otherwise doesn't rearrange very much the structure of the wave function. So once you have this decomposition, then you have the ability to describe an exponentially large number of states with a polynomial number of parameters, and that's in essence what quasi-particles are all about. All right, so that's a somewhat formal definition of what a quasi-particle is, and I chose this definition because it also applies in disordered systems or any generic system. But you can't measure any of these things, so how do you characterize a system with quasi-particles? You can talk about various relaxation or dissipation times. For example, thermal equilibration time. So if you kick a system, how long does it take to reach thermal equilibrium? Well, this is a question that Boltzmann already answered in the 19th century using the Boltzmann equation. And his answer was, well, it's just a few collision times between the particles. At least locally, the system established equilibrium. And that's also true for quantum quasi-particles. You just have to use the quantum Boltzmann equation. In the case they are fermions, then typically the equilibration time goes the inverse of the interaction strength squared. And then you get a factor of temperature squared basically from the Fermi distribution function and then various dimensionful parameters to make this have the dimension of time. So this is a time that diverges as temperature goes to zero in this power 1 over temperature squared. So another way to define a system with quasi-particles is to say that it takes really a long time to equilibrate. Because quasi-particles are approximate eigenstates, they have to really find each other before they realize they're only approximate. And then you thermalize. But a quantity that people usually measure is a time that you get from the resistance. So if you apply the Drude theory of transport of quasi-particles, which is essentially Boltzmann's theory, then you have this important formula for the resistance that's going to play a key role in my discussion today. There's the effective mass of the quasi-particles, the total density of particles, and the electron charge. So these are things that are usually known for any system. So if you measure the resistance, you can read off this quantity that has a dimension of time, which people just call the scattering time or the transport time. And typically, in a Fermi liquid theory, this time is of the same order, roughly, as the equilibration time. And so the resistance then has two important properties. First of all, it goes as T squared. And secondly, the coefficient of T squared depends on the strength of the interactions, because tau depends on the strength of the interactions. Here, E is just a, this E is not supposed to be due to interaction. That's just simply in the definition of the current. Okay, then one final thing. This time tau, I said, is very long, and so you can naturally ask, long compared to what? So these days people are calling this particular time that you can make out of Planck's constant and absolute temperature the Planckian time. We can't call it the Boltzmann. The Boltzmann constant is a fake constant, which you wouldn't need if the temperature was measured in units of energy. So it's a Planckian time, which involves nothing but fundamental constant. And this time will play a fundamental role in everything I'm going to discuss. It's a very natural time that appears anytime a very strongly interacting system, which obeys certain strong scaling properties. And we're going to see that in the models I'm going to discuss. So this basic time, one can think of as some very rapid time in which a system can equilibrate, and there's some formal sense in which people have argued it's the fastest possible time. And so the time that we've discussed so far for Fermi liquids is always much larger than the Planckian time as temperature goes to zero. So this is another, you could almost view this as a definition of system with quasi-particles. If this is true, then you have quasi-particles. Even if you may not know how to find them, there may be some secret quasi-particles hanging around in some dual representation. But if you could measure such times, you could at least get a hint. And if it's much larger than h-bar over kBT, then perhaps there's a way to define quasi-particles. Okay, so that's a quick summary of conventional transport in ordinary metals. All right, so now let me turn to recent experiments where people are claiming to see what they call Planckian transports. I'll show the references in a minute. And these experiments, all in the last year or so, are in very different materials, in cuprates, nictides, magic angle graphene, and ultra-cold atoms. And roughly speaking, what they've all done is try to measure the resistance as a function of temperature more carefully in a lower temperature regime, in better characterized sample, and so on, where they know the values of these constants here, m star n and e squared, the way experimentalists define them in some reasonable way where you measure them perhaps in a region where quasi-particles were better characterized. And then you read off the value of temperature tau, and they find two remarkable things. First of all, that 1 over tau goes as temperature, not as temperature squared. That's, of course, a somewhat old thing by now. It's already seen in the very first experiment of the cuprates, that resistivity of linear temperature. But also another factor that's been emphasized, I guess, initially by Andy McKenzie, but more recently in these papers too, that the coefficient here is pretty close to 1. It's just the Planckian time, but essentially nothing there. So here are the experiments that I've just mentioned. There's the experiment of the cuprates by the Taillefer and Proust groups. There's the experiments by the Maryland group on the nictides. There's the MIT observation of strange metal behavior and magic angle graphene. As you can see, the word Planckian dissipation seems to have made it to the title of these papers now. I didn't come up with it. and this is an experiment in coal atoms, which is somewhat higher temperatures, of order the Fermi energy, where there's also some similar behavior. Okay, so this is the basic puzzle that I want to try to understand. I'm not going to claim you understand it, but at least we'll cook up a model, if you wish, which has this such a property. And then it's an open question of how generic and applicable our model is. I also wanted to show you this table from the Taillefer paper, where they looked at the resistivity at high fields and low temperatures of a number of high-temperature superconductors. These are the cuprates, electron and hole doped, and also some organic compound. And knowing various quantities, which they measure by other methods, from the resistance, you can, first of all, they find 1 over tau is proportional to T. They can read off this number alpha. It's a pure number. And the main thing to notice is that number is, within a factor of 2, close to 1. And this is quite, in many different systems with very different energy scales, it's basically 1. And this is kind of what we want to understand. Okay, so I think this is, in some sense, one of the major puzzles out there in the study of strongly correlated systems. Yes?
What did you measure, N and M star? Is it like quantum oscillation?
So N, of course, the density. That's not a problem. Yeah, M star, is, in this case, I believe it's quantum oscillations. Yeah. Could be specific heat gamma also in some cases.
Most of these don't show quantum
oscillations. Oh, you're right. Yeah, you're right. Thank you. Okay. Yeah, so there's some black magic in how you do this. I agree. but I would say that, an experimentalist will shout at each other, oh, no, you're doing this all nonsense, meaningless. Well, I would say that I think the fact that there's some systematic trend here, which is seen by many different people in many different contexts, that needs explanation. yes.
In the case of the cuprates, they're measuring at optimal doping, right?
Yes, it's close to optimal doping, I believe.
The feature of linear anti-resistivity is an extended region of the face.
So it's optimal, and in fact, the more recent observation on the overdope side. In the overdope side, where you put very high fields to destroy the superconductivity, it seems to be linear over an extended region down to very low temperatures. Yeah. That, in some sense, is the most puzzling aspect also. Yeah. All right, so there's something to be understood. You can argue whether some of the experimentalists were not being entirely consistent in the way they interpret the parameters. But despite that, I think there's an undeniable trend which needs to be understood. All right, so this is going to be, I'm going to use the so-called SYK model as a starting point. So this is just a model that can be solved, which has no quasi-particles, and we'll study its properties and then try to think how to build an actual metallic state out of it. So the model is very simply defined. It's a model with some, if you have these labels, alpha, beta, gamma, delta, that run from 1 through n, and you can think of alpha, if you want, as just some orbital label. These are different, it's a multi-orbital atom, and then many orbitals with labeled, which n, I'm going to take the limit, n goes to infinity. So there's no sense of space yet, and the whole point of the talk will be to how do you put a sense of space in this model. And there's an interaction, I guess you'd call this some configuration interaction in some generalized Hubbard model. And this interaction, U alpha beta gamma delta, has chosen to have zero mean, although that's not so essential. But the important point is that these interaction numbers are all independent random numbers. And we just take the variance of them to be u squared. Okay, so that's it. And I'm going to need this later, so I'm going to imagine that, think of these alphas as labels of some pre-existing quasi-particles, which we want to destroy. And each quasi-particle then has the energy epsilon. So right now, the quasi-particles are all exactly degenerate, and then they start interacting with each other. So that's the model. Okay, so this model has very many nice properties, most important being, first of all, that it's self-averaging to a high degree. So even though every site is not equivalent to every other site, if you measure essentially the Green's function or a variety of correlation functions locally, they're the same on every site. And this has been checked numerically, very accurately. You have to look at some very subtle or to very high degree of precision, almost e to the minus n, before you see any site-to-site fluctuations. So that's good. Since it's self-averaging, you can use very simple techniques to solve it. You can just average over disorder without worrying too much. So how do you solve it? Well, today we'd say we solve it by summing these graphs, these Mellin diagrams. Basically, it's the sum of all of these graphs, which are basically these three-point graphs like this to all orders in all graphs, is the exact solution of this model as n goes to infinity. So we solved this model by a somewhat different method way back when, in 25 years ago more. Then a few years later, we worked a lot with Antoine George and Olivier Parkelet and worked out a few more properties. But the disadvantage of the model we worked on those days, which I won't write up, was that it was not easy to put on the computer. And it involved somewhat more complicated large n limit. And then Alexei Kitaev proposed a model closely related to this, which has the same property, the same large n limit, but has one big advantage, as far as I was concerned, was that it allowed easy check on the computer. You can just put it on the computer and check. And somehow, fortunately, all the calculations we did have now been checked, and they're completely correct. They fit numerical data, so there's no problems with any of it. We were, of course, very worried about issues of replica symmetry breaking and self-averaging and many other things, and somehow we got it right. Okay, so what is one of the basic properties that you see? So if you just measure a Green's function, so this is the Green's function to add an electron at site at orbital alpha and then annihilate at time tau later. And you have to annihilate on the same alpha because the amplitude for going to a different alpha is just zero in the larger limit. And this decays as 1/√ of time, as does the other process where you remove a particle at site at orbital alpha and add it at time tau later. But one quantity that will play a crucial role in everything I have to say is this fact that the amplitude of this decay is not the same for particle and hole propagation in general. And we parameterize in this strange way as this factor e to the minus 2 pi big E, where E is some dimensionless number. Okay, why did I put the factor 2 pi there? That's, I don't know, goes back when, or some papers a long time ago. But it's related to the fact that this model is dual to a black hole, and the E is actually the electric field on the surface of the black hole. But that won't be important for what I'm discussing. So what is E determined by in this model? Well, it's first of all, the original model has two dimensionful parameters. One is U, the strength of the interaction, and the other is this quasi-particle energy epsilon. Usually people just put this to zero, which is the particle-hole symmetric case. But I don't want to do that. I'm going to play with that, as you'll see. So it turns out, at least for small epsilon, it's a linear function of epsilon, because epsilon determines a particle-hole asymmetry. And so dimensionally, it can only be this thing, C epsilon over U. And this number, capital C, well, just remember that. We're going to use that number in a crucial way. It'll turn out to be important for the resistivity. OK. So that's the solution. I should note, but first of all, this kind of solution is very different from a Fermi liquid. A Fermi liquid, the decay of such kind of or disordered Fermi liquid, this decays as 1/tau from the constant density of states on the Fermi level. And moreover, it's particle hole symmetric. So a Fermi liquid has asymptotic particle hole symmetry near the Fermi surface. The amplitude is the same for particle in a hole. But it's not true in general in this non-Fermi liquid here with this exponent 1/√ tau. Okay, so that's one basic property. Then you can look at finite temperature. So what I'm plotting here is the finite temperature Green's function when the quasi-particles all have energy epsilon. And one very important property of this is that it's only a function of the ratio of frequency and temperature. Or as we'd say today, it has a Planckian frequency dependence. and this is because of some strong scaling properties of the solution. In fact, at low energies, there's conformal invariance in the solution. There's an emergent conformal symmetry, which was first noticed by George and Parcolet. And then you can actually solve the integral equations exactly, and out pops this type of solution you might see in a conformal field theory. So it has a width of order temperature, so it's a Planck, and it's independent. So the damping of these excitations, it has nothing to do with the strength of the interaction, just determined by the Planckian time. So that's great. This is the particle hole symmetric case. Now there's a solution for every epsilon. If you solve it for a different epsilon, you get a peak at, say, positive energy for positive epsilon, and that's negative epsilon, and then something in between. Okay. So there's, in fact, a one-parameter family of so-called complex SYK models, just depending upon what, if you wish, the density of particles is. So if you have n sites and you have n over 2 particles, then that's the epsilon equals 0 solution for the Green's function. If you add more particles, then you get another system which has some different charge and has a different spectral function. Okay, so these are all different one-parameter solution depending on how many particles are in the system. And it turns out there's also, which I won't talk about, this number big E has a universal relation to the charge. And that's like a Luttinger theorem, just like KF has a universal relation to charge. there's a Luttinger theorem here which relates this particle hole asymmetry dimensionless parameter to the charge. Okay. Another property which initially we were very disturbed by, but not so much anymore, I think, but is that this system has a non-zero, zero temperature entropy. Notice I didn't say ground state entropy. It's not, ground state entropy would mean there's an exponentially large ground state degeneracy. That's not the case. What it has is an exponentially small spacing between energy levels near the ground state. So there's no degeneracy at all. The degeneracies are, you know, numbers like one or two or something like that. But there's many, many levels at very low energy. Now, exponentially small spacing is nothing, you know, nothing surprising in general in a many-body system. In any many-body system, in the middle of the spectrum, the spacing is exponentially small in the many-body levels. What's special about the system is that spacing is exponentially small down to the ground state. Typically, in other systems, at least at the very bottom of the band, the spacing becomes a power law in N rather than an exponential in N. Okay, so that's, and this has numerically been confirmed, and in fact, even numerically, this value of the entropy that we computed in 2001 has been since obtained by many other methods, and it's correct. And it was obtained by some kind of Luttinger argument and the Maxwell relation, which follows from this, which I won't talk about. Okay, so this entropy is there, and it's a very robust entropy. It can only be lifted by, as I'll show you in a minute, by adding a dispersion to the quasiparticles. But it's not lifted by adding further interactions, or you know, you just take a generic, even take a single sample with random interactions, you will see these states. They're there. And numerically, that's been seen. So it's very robust. Okay. All right, so that's the review then of some of the properties of the what's called now called the complex SYK model. So it's characterized, as I said, by two dimensionful energies, the U and this energy epsilon, which is the particle hole asymmetry. All right, so what we'd like to do is add some dispersion. Make this something that has the particles not exactly degenerate and has some sense of real space. And a lot of work has been done in that direction. And generally, you can characterize all the models I've been looked at by this more very general Hamiltonian. Basically, what I've done in this case is just added another index. So alpha, beta, gamma, delta, as before. And now I had another index, which is k, so that the energy of the quasiparticles all depends on k. Okay. So this is, you know, of course, k in this case will be a momentum, but it could be something else if you wished. And then the interaction will depend on all the k's. Okay. So now you have some bandwidth of the incipient quasiparticles, the epsilon k, in addition to this very strong interaction between them. And you can ask, and let's say the bandwidth is w, let's ask what happens. So what happens then is that this nice scaling behavior that I showed you with this zero temperature entropy and Planckian scaling disappears at very low temperatures. And okay, so that's good. But what was an interesting observation, which actually goes back to George and Parcollet, is that the temperature at which it disappears is actually lower than you would naively think. It's not W, which is what you'd naively think. It's W squared over U, where U is the interaction strength. So there's a wide temperature window in which you have exactly the behavior just described. And below this temperature, this W squared over U, you recover a conventional Fermi liquid behavior with vanishing entropy and T squared resistivity. But in this regime, you, in fact, okay, I haven't shown you that yet. There's Planckian dynamics for the Green's function, that's kind of clear. What the resistivity is a little more subtle, and I'll talk about that in a minute. Okay, so this is the model that people have studied, and so one virtualization of such a model is this one, where you right now have written it in real space rather than momentum space. So here you have sites labeled by I and J, that's the second index. And here you have hopping between nearest neighbor sites, so the electrons can move around. And on each site, you have a multi-orbital atom with on the orbital, on each site anyway, they are degenerate, but again, you can lift that if you wished. with some interaction U alpha beta gamma delta. And in this case, I've chosen that to be just an independent random number on each atom. Just, again, that's also not necessary. So you can see from the colors that each atom looks different. You can make them all look exactly the same, and you get very similar results. Okay, so what happens? So the question now you can ask is, what happens in this regime, which was t squared, between t squared over u and u? Well, what you find there is what people now call an incoherent metal, where, in fact, the Green's function is exactly the SYK Green's function I just showed you with this Planckian dissipation, but it has no dependence on momentum k. It's independent of k. So there's some epsilon here that appears, which is just determined by the total density and the Luttinger theorem. So that's what you get. So this means that this particular system is, you know, not what you see in the experiment. It has no sense of a Fermi surface at all. It's just k independent. The momentum doesn't depend on anything. But one very nice property of this particular state is that if you now compute the resistivity in this regime, in this high temperature, this intermediate temperature regime here, which can be very wide, just by the Kubo formula, you find a resistance that's linear in temperature. So that's really interesting. And that's not by any means obvious thing. The fact that it's linear here depends very much on the fact that this exponent way back when was a square root. The fact that there's a square root over here and there's a square root over here is very much connected to the fact that the resistance is linear. There are other models with NQ body interactions where these exponents are all different and the resistivity is not linear. Anyway, so, which is a bit of an unfortunate thing because, you know, many other things give linear, including just the Taylor series expansion in some low temperature, you might imagine. But it's really quite a non-trivial consequence of this type of model that it has give you linear resistivity. So that's great. But what is the coefficient? Well, in this case, there's no sense of a Fermi surface, so there's no natural way to relate it to Fermi surface quantities, which is what was done in the experiments. So you find the resistance unit of h over e squared is just the ratio of these two energy scales, kBT divided by t squared over u. Okay. All right, so you know, that's a step forward in understanding the experiments, I believe, but it's still a little bit away from what's actually seen. So there's another model people have looked at. Whoops. Oh, gosh, I got my slides all messed up here. Oh, no, I'm missing a slide. Oh, it's here it is. Okay. So here's another model. It's a two-band model. So what you do is here you have some mobile electrons, which I'm calling C, which are moving around in some regular band. So they have a well-defined Fermi surface. And these mobile electrons interact by some exchange interactions to a series of these islands, which are each described by the SYK model. So you can think of this as like a Kondo lattice or a Kondo SYK model. And so in this case, you do find, again, for somewhat different reasons, a linear and T resistance. And the electron spectral function of the C electrons has the form of a marginal Fermi liquid. So that's all very nice. You've got a Fermi surface. You've got linear and T resistivity. But what's not good is that the size of the Fermi surface is just totally wrong. The size of the Fermi surface only includes the mobile electrons, not the electrons sitting in these islands, and that's not what you want. You want all the electrons to contribute to the Fermi surface. And there is no, at least in the cuprates, there's no natural distinction between mobile and stationary electrons. So in that sense, this model is somewhat artificial. I mean, this model is very similar to various holographic and other models of marginally Fermi liquids, and they all have this same shortcoming. Okay, so let me go back to this model now, this lattice SYK model, and I'm going to generalize it. So now I'm finally getting to the new work. So let me the first thing I want to do is rewrite this in momentum space. So I'm just going to take this thing as shown, and just rewrite it in momentum space. So in momentum space, then you have some dispersion, epsilon k, and you have some interaction, alpha, beta, gamma, delta, which depends on all the k's here. And now to make this u alpha, beta, gamma, delta site independent, you know, random on each side and uncorrelated between different sites and translationally invariant on average, what you need is a second moment, which is basically k independent, apart from just one constraint that conserves total momentum. And this just makes sure that the model has a average, is translationally invariant on average. That's all you know. So this is the same model that I've just described all the work on, just rewritten simply. All right, so now I'm going to make a bold step. I'm going to modify this model just slightly, not so slightly, you be the judge. I'm going to impose what I'm going to call as a resonance condition. So if I have a scattering event here between quasi-particles, k1, k2, going to k3, k4, I'm going to impose that in all the Green's function I take into account, this event is on resonance, that the initial quasi-particle energy, the bare quasi-particle energy, or the k's, ek's, are the same before and after. And it's easy to impose this just by putting in a delta function in the two-point correlations of these interactions. So this is some model which has kind of a power law correlations of these u alpha, beta, gamma, delta. That's all. Now, so how can I justify this? Well, you can kind of justify it in a very hand-waving RG sort of way, where you say that you have all these systems that initially had some quasi-particles. They start interacting with each other strongly. And all the virtual processes, where you're just quasi-particles are normalizing each other, you take into account and redefine them in the value of epsilon k itself. So all virtual processes are absorbed in the redefinition of epsilon k. And the remaining resonant processes, this is what you would do in degenerate perturbation theory too, you take into account self-consistently to all orders. So that's what we're going to do. Okay, yes, this is the key step, so.
Yeah, just to make sure, so the model as you define is not translationally invariant.
It is translationally invariant.
Statistically translationally invariant.
No, it's not exactly. Even the previous model wasn't, yeah. Yeah, because of this factor here, this particular factor, it's statistically translationally invariant. It definitely has randomness. Now, one important thing I'm going to compute the resistivity in this model, and this is what held us up for a while. So once you make this k independent, there's also a current contribution from this term. And let me assure you, we have taken all of that into account. Yes.
To me, this resonant condition also looks like just saying that all the epsilon k's have a much larger range of interactions. Is that a good way of?
But we want to work in the regime where the, well, much larger range. Yeah, it's like an infinite bandwidth. But we want, you could say it that way. You could say it that way, right. So there's a limiting case of this, which is what we also considered, where we just say that the momentum space divides into shells, and there's only interaction within a shell, independent. So it could be like a cake model of the.
Like if the shells are really far apart compared to the U.
Yeah. So in this case, of course, the shells all interact. They're only conserving the total energy, but there's an even further simplification. But you're right. Yeah. All right, so this is the model. This is it. This still requires some numerical solution, but you can simplify it even further and solve the whole thing analytically. Anyway, but one property of this model, which is in a way we came up with this, is that it has a very remarkable property. Even though there's dispersion here, it has a property that this Planckian dissipation holds down to zero temperature. So in fact, now the g of k and omega has this Planckian dissipation as function of omega, but this epsilon, this particle hole asymmetry, it depends on k. It depends on the k you started with. And this dimensionless number ek, capital Ek, is proportional to epsilon ek as before. So the only thing you have to determine when you solve this model numerically by solving the whole thing on a computer is this number C. Other than the number C, we know everything analytically. So this is the basic property of the model. Let me try to show you why this claim holds. Okay, there's no proof of this. Well, we can show that there is a solution of the equations at low energies which obeys this. And then with the further assumption that the solutions are unique, which generally haven't in all the numerics that's been the case, then this is the solution. Yeah?
So the randomness is only an interaction.
Well, you could. I don't think it would make. They're probably variants, but you could. But we're not putting it in. Yeah, it's not so. Yeah, I mean, it's simpler to just put. But we do need it in the interactions. It's not a way to do it without in the interaction. There were other models we tried where we didn't have any randomness. In fact, that's what Avishkar was working on a long time. They have the trouble that. Then there's a contribution to the current from the interaction because the interaction depends on position, so there's a Pyrrhus factor in the interaction when you apply an electric field, and that turns out to dominate everything. It becomes just too... So to make this whole thing work, we do need to put randomness in interactions. And I kind of believe that's also important for the experiments, especially when you see this linear resistivity down to zero temperature. Okay, but here's there's the model. I mean, here it is. This is the model, okay? We can now try to solve it. All right, so why is this true? Well, this particular Green's function I showed you, this gamma function, looks very complicated in frequency space, but in time, it's actually something very simple. It's got this familiar conformal factor. And because of the particle hole asymmetry, the only thing that's consistent with conformal invariance is this exponential factor with this number e over there. So when you have a dispersion, when your Green's function depends on the quasi-particle energy epsilon, there's an extra factor here. Okay, so now you have to put this into the self-consistent Mellon equations and make sure this factor doesn't destroy the conformal invariance. It's precisely this factor that destroys it in the generic model. That many people have solved. Okay, so if you have these three, so each of these Green's functions here comes with this factor. You take the product of them, and what you want is for this factor to equal the factor that would be present in the bare Green's function with momentum k1. So it should be equal to that. And now you see this is true as long as this is true. As long as you are on the resonant condition. So if you only have resonant interactions, then you're able to extend the solution down to zero temperature. Okay, so that's one very nice property here. So here's another model which has dispersion. So this is, I think, a unique model, as I know of, that has the following properties. It has dispersion, it can be defined at any density, it's compressible, and it's critical down to zero temperature. there are various models of Fermi surfaces coupled to gauge fields which have similar properties, but those have negligible resistance. So this means that these curves I showed you as a function of epsilon now simply become the electron spectral function as a function of momentum, because all you're doing as you change momentum is change the value of epsilon. Notice, however, the dispersion is rather weak. It's of order temperature. This means that at least near the Fermi surface, the effective mass is very large. Fermi velocity is very small. In fact, it's diverging as 1 over temperature. I don't know sure that's true in experiments or not. It'll be interesting to check. Okay, so this is, and so there's no real Fermi surface. It's a disordered system, but the Fermi surface disappears because of the random interactions, but there's still some remnant of it. It's not just completely gone. Okay, so now let's compute the resistance. So it turns out in the model as defined, and this is where most of the work was over several months that Avishkar and I struggled with. For this particular model, everything is perfectly okay, and the conductivity is just given by the Kolbe formula. You just take this imaginary part of the Green's function, you put this is just the Fermi DFTE, and you integrate over momentum and omega, and all of these are defined just from the incipient quasi-particle dispersion. Okay, so it's just a matter of doing this integral now, and what you get is exactly what you wanted. You want to get a resistance, first of all, linear in temperature, great. It has a prefactor, which is m star over n e squared, where m star is exactly this. Is in any dimension for any shape of the Fermi surface, it's just equal to this. This is not exactly the usual definition of m star, but for any circular Fermi surface in any dimension, this is m star, exact m star. So it's slightly different, maybe a few percent from the usual specific heat or other definition of m star. So given some dispersion epsilon k, you can work out what m star is. And then finally, okay, so that's great. You get exactly what you want here. What is the coefficient? Well, the coefficient turns out, you know, this, you know everything here except this number c. So this is what you get, 2.71 times c. And right now we are in the process of computing c in various models numerically. And okay, there's a lot of work to be done there, but hopefully Avishkar is slowly have everything together. But there's one very simple model where we can actually even compute c. And that's the model I briefly mentioned a few minutes ago. This is the same result here. So first of all, very beautiful thing about this result is that there's no explicit dependent on u. Of course, the number c does depend on some dimensional parameter like w over u. So that's where it's hidden there. But that's a relatively weak dependence, okay. So this is then a theory of what we're calling a Planckian metal. So this is the British coin. I should have mentioned this earlier. It's made of an ordinary metal, but it really should be made of a strange metal, right? Maybe someday. Okay, what is the number C? So we have computed it in a very simple model, and this is, if you wish, I mentioned briefly, the independent momentum shell model. So I don't have any justification for this model other than the fact it's easy to work with. You can do everything analytically. So this is the case where the interactions are only within a shell. So each electron only interacts with other electrons at the same energy, which is not quite the resonance. The resonance condition is weaker, that the total energy is conserved. Here you conserve everything. If you just take that model, you can solve the whole thing. In fact, the C is exactly the C that was determined ages ago for the SYK model, and you get 1.11. So, all right. So that's the main result. And okay, so let me just conclude then. So Planckian dynamics is what we used to call omega over T scaling, where the dissipative or relaxational times are just functions of KT over H bar and not independent of the interactions. And the SYK model is the simplest model that realizes such a dynamics. The resonant SYK model is what we have introduced here, are compressible and dissipative quantum systems with Planckian dynamics as T goes to zero. And those are, you know, kind of unique characteristics. And as I said, also just to remind you where this resonance condition comes from, it just came out of thin air really, but roughly, our idea is that we take all the off-resonant interactions and include them in the epsilon k itself. And only the resonant interactions, as in degenerate perturbation theory, you take into account more exactly and self-consistently. So this gives you a Planckian metal with, knowing the dispersion, you have an M star and also has a sign of a Fermi surface, this particular Planckian metal, and it gives you a resistivity, which is linear in temperature with a coefficient here, which in some cases is exactly one, close to one, and others, you know, maybe by a factor of two will be pretty close to that. I have a few more slides on the connection of this to black holes, but since I'm out of time, I'll just stop right here.
Have an sort of an RG way of accessing this fixed point from free fermions, or is it just so strong coupling that?
I don't know if you can do it from free fermions. I mean,
not from free fermions.
If you have to start from something like DMFT or something of the Hubbard model, So there is actually a nice paper by Philip Werner who solved the MFT type equations on, I think it was 2 or 3 orbital Hubbard model for the nictides. And he finds wide regimes of behavior with the Green's function of SYK. You just agree with that. So yeah, we'd love to do that. I don't think, you know, this model kind of came out of thinking of that time, you know, how do you start with some random model and make it flow to somewhere that you want to. So we now know where we want it to flow. We don't quite know how to show it does that. Yeah.
I don't understand exactly what the statement is opposed from the surface. Is it sharp or not?
No, this is a disordered system. There's no, but there is, I would say that the statement is that there is a momentum at which the peak of the spectral function is at zero energy. That's my Fermi surface.
So it's not sharp.
Why I call it remnant. You want a better word? It's a remnant. It's not actually a Fermi surface. It's a random system. There are no Fermi surfaces.
Yeah.
There is an underlying Fermi surface we start with, mm-hmm. These epsilon k. And then we put in these resonant interactions. Mm-hmm. And unlike previous model where it completely wiped it out, here it doesn't completely wipe it out. It does give you this kind of weak effect. So you could look at the renormalized spectral function and identify where it is.
But is it a Luttinger remnant?
Yes, it's a Luttinger remnant. Yeah. And it has a large, it includes all the electrons.
In the lattice SYK model, do you care at all about how the tunneling rate compares to the interaction strength?
We want it to be smaller.
You want the tunneling rate to be smaller?
In that definition, yes. But in this resonant momentum space definition, you're right. We want an infinite bandwidth. But the interaction rate, this is more like a weaker interaction model that we have introduced. These are exactly the point that Avishkar has been insisting to me, so. Yes.
At some point you mentioned that the YK islands are multi-orbital.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, how does the scaling in temperature changes if you include one over n corrections? If you just don't work at n equals infinity, but at finite n?
So if you take a single SYK model, it's a question of time, frequency scale. There's frequency, so of course, first of all, I don't know if I ever put that down. At some point, I may have put this down. There is various factors of n that I unfortunately may have suppressed. So this is not exactly, there's a factor of n. So there's n to the 3/2 here. So you pull these factors out carefully so that this thing has variance about of u. So once you do this, then there are various times. So here I'm assuming you take the large n limit and you take frequencies of order temperature of order 1 and take the large n limit. You can ask about frequencies of order 1 over n, or frequencies of order e to the minus n, what happens? Now that's been studied in great detail by Douglas Stanford and Steve Shanker and so on. And there's many different asymptotic regimes where frequencies of order 1 over n and frequencies of order e to the minus n, and the behaviors are totally different in those regimes. The amazing thing is you can even define such small frequencies and ask about meaningful questions because the level spacing is so tiny. 1 over n is still quite a large, large energy scale compared to e to the minus n. So here I'm assuming that this is the right way to do it. So certainly if I'm in this regime, omega over t of order 1 and much smaller than n, then there are no corrections to the exponents. These are exact results in that regime.
Probably go to coffee break, so it's thanks to you again.